John Lindgren is president and co-founder of an antiquarian bookselling business specializing in printed and manuscript cookery based Maine. He buys and sells books and ephemera in all fields related to food and drink, including gastronomy, wine and spirits, mushrooms and foraging, beekeeping, farming and gardening, and has a strong interest in the cookbook as artifact, especially those which exhibit evidence of use. He works with clients worldwide to source rare books, develop private collections, and place collections and archives of importance with appropriate institutions. He appraises books, manuscripts, ephemera, and archives in these and other fields. He's a member of the Antiquarian Booksellers Association of America, the International League of Antiquarian Booksellers, the Ephemera Society of America, the Bibliographical Society of America, the Wayward Tendrils, whatever that is, and the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association. Welcome, Don, once again to the Bibliophile.
Thanks, Nigel. It's great to be back with you.
Okay. So I'm going to start off with a quote from Book Collecting, A Modern Guide, edited by Gene Peters, published by Bowker in 1977. Dealers' catalogs vary in every possible way, in size, in method of printing, in length and importance of annotations and comments. Beginning collectors sometimes make the mistake of neglecting well-made and well-printed catalogs because they assume the contents to be beyond their financial reach. Similarly, some collectors consider themselves too grand to read mimeographed lists. Both groups need to remember that it is only by experience that they will learn which dealers' catalogs they can afford to avoid. Surface appearances are frequently deceptive. So with that, let's start our conversation about bookseller catalogs. We talked about structuring it so that we deal with two main categories, one of design and one of content. So perhaps you could take us into design to start with, Don.
Yes, I just wanted to reflect for a second on the fact that when you contacted me and we got talking about bookseller catalogs, it forced me into my own collection of bookseller catalogs, which isn't a formal collection. It's something that aids me in my work and amuses me in my downtime. I have a sort of taxonomic brain, so I like to break things down into categories and then go back and look at the literature to see what I may have missed. In short, bookseller catalogs are an incredibly overlooked, really interesting and dynamic form of literature that's been with us since the beginning of bookselling, which really is from the beginning of printed books. But I'm going to start with a quote of my own. It's not my own.
Oh, good. Touché.
This is a quote from Somerset Maugham, and it's, "The lists of secondhand booksellers are more entertaining than half the novels that are written." And of course, he's not even talking about as entertaining as in the world of nonfiction. So you wanted to start by talking
about... Yeah, I mean, I think to respond to that, I've always thought that just given the amount of effort that's involved in producing these things, that they're really, really good value. They're not expensive, and many of them are absolutely beautiful. And also the amount of work, the scholarship and research that goes into these things is extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that they technically fit into the broader world of ephemera. Their number one purpose is to sell the material contained within. That's their primary purpose. As such, they have a sort of fixed lifespan. They're not intended, at least most of them are not intended to last the way that a published book by a university press or an exhibition catalog from a special collections department of a library to last as a permanent reference. Most are really not that different from what I have in front of me. And I know people don't see these things, but I'm just going to refer to it as if they do. This is a grocery circular that I'm looking at, and it's one of my favorite ones because I love whoever or whatever designed this one from Market Basket, which is a New England grocery chain. It's just always fun to look at.
Right.
But the point is to sell the material within, get people to come into the shop, and then it's gone. It's over.
Yep. Yep.
And for the,
it's done its job.
It's done its job. And for the vast majority of bookseller catalogs, that's, you know, it's not that different. We booksellers would like to think it's different, but it's related, and it's fulfilling the same sort of function. But the range of ways that booksellers approach their catalogs and create their catalogs is the range is huge. And the catalogs themselves and how they come to be, what they look like, the material within them, it reflects a lot of different influences. A lot of different sort of structural forces are at work to make catalogs that may be a very simple typed list, of which is the first one we'll discuss, is that sort of laundry list of items, which has a bookseller's name and address. And in the old days, it was frequently, not the very old days, but in my old days, it was a PO box somewhere. These, you know, and then a list of books that were in a field, generally, because small dealers frequently were specialists. But the, you know, the descriptions may contain, and I'm looking at one here from 1956. This is Edmund Kowalczyk, bookseller of Worcester, Mass. He says, you know, books searched for, libraries purchased. And this is his catalog 25. No, item number one, First Lieutenant Abbott, and the title Negro Soldier in the War of the Rebellion, Chicago, 1899, bound in stiff wrappers, $1. And that's right. The whole description. There's no condition description. There is no description of really what the contents are. We don't know if it's illustrated or has maps. And in a way that may not at that moment have been necessary. It's 8 pages long, printed. This one is mimeograph with a single staple in the upper left-hand corner, and then folded once and addressed on one side with a stamp. And there was presumably some little adhesive thing that held it closed. But this was the whole thing. And, you know, when I started selling books in the early 1980s, working for other booksellers, this is most of what I saw. It looked like this. The books were seemingly sort of random to an uninitiated person. You know, this is what it was. And even from booksellers that were vaunted booksellers at the top of the trade, the list would often look like this. And that's because there was no internet. This is the way one would produce a list with a typewriter. It's before word processing. And that mimeograph and the single staple was used. And of course, the U.S. Postal Service to deliver it. So the physical form was kind of what was possible to people. How much content they put there was another factor. But of course, the content is limited by the form. If you were to describe each one of these books, this would suddenly become a 32-page list.
Right, which would obviously affect the cost of mailing, too.
Absolutely. The cost of mailing, the cost of printing, not to mention the much greater amount of time the bookseller would have to spend to put the list together. But there's also the factor that may not have been necessary for most booksellers and for most collectors at that time. And if you go back further in time, you'll see many lists from many booksellers that are very simple, even describing very ancient books, that the condition may have been a secondary factor, much less important than it seems to be these days. And that there was an understanding that the rest of it, you knew what you were looking for. This was reflected also in the way that people would look through A.B. Bookman's Weekly. And there would just be pages and pages of books listed for sale, and then pages and pages of books listed that people were looking for. And it was just author title, sometimes publisher, author title publisher in short form, lists and lists and lists of single spaced items people were seeking. So all of the rest of that description wasn't necessary for that.
I guess what these booksellers assumed was that the people that were receiving this list, they must have already known about the book. They must have known the details about the book, because they don't spend a lot of time talking about what's in it or what the condition is, right?
That's right. And I'm not sure that most booksellers thought that was their job. I think if one was to pick a random title and look it up on, say, ABE Books right now, you'd notice that most booksellers listing there still don't think it's their job to tell you what's in the book. They may give you some sense of condition. They may just say, might be a used book, might have underlining, may have maybe missing cover and some other boilerplate disclaimer. So that type of book selling is still going on. And of course, there's a huge range between the non-description and the very complete description, which we'll talk about later. Yep. My own first catalog, which I had forgotten about.
You mean, Don, you mean this one?
No, there's actually one. That, so that is the my first catalog as Rabelais and dealing in books on food and drink.
It's kind of a nice sausage dong right on the front cover.
Well, I wanted it to look very different from other catalogs. And then that great image of a salami from Hans Gissinger, who produced a fantastic book of images of salami, seemed to be something that would get people's attention.
It sure did. It's fantastic.
But 17 years earlier, I produced a catalog back in, when I was doing more academic and art books. And it too, this is Xerox, this is not mimeographed, but you know, it's a Xerox list, very, very short descriptions. I was just learning what book descriptions were, what the formatting might be and what the terms for description would be. And I produced this at, and here's a business we no longer think about, but it may be around still, Kinko's. I took this to the local Kinko's on campus and, you know, and printed it and stapled it and mailed it out to my 14 customers.
But how many books do you sell?
Well, the copy that I showed you actually is my desk copy, and it's marked. It is indeed marked up. The neat thing about this is that I had a conversation with a librarian very recently that mentioned this catalog, and because it was the first book I sold out of printed catalog, and it was a sort of odd architectural piece. And I sold it to a librarian at Columbia University, who's now at another institution. And I was speaking with her about food and drink material. And she said, you know, I bought this book, and she mentioned, she remembered it by name. This is 30 years ago, 25 years ago, I'll say that. And she remembered and said that was a book that meant a lot to me as a librarian. I think it may have been like the first book she acquired for the institution or something when she was a young librarian. Anyway, you know, we're talking about the design and.
Yeah, we're talking design, about mimeograph to start with and limited description. So what was the move from there and why?
Well, I do want to reference the sort of pre, you know, mimeograph is a 20th century thing. Yeah. Bookselling catalogs have been around for a very long time. They generally mimicked, and I don't, that's a world of bookselling catalogs I'm not so familiar with. There are other people like Nina Musinski in New York who frequently has some really lovely early bookselling catalogs and library catalogs and the like in her offerings. But I find that the earlier ones from the physical point of view mimic or are more traditional, that they are, you know, printed by small publishers, forms that we would recognize that seem like regular books. And it's in the 20th century, really, where booksellers wanted access to printing, but didn't need to produce very large quantities of things. That's still a factor that affects the way I print my catalogs. I usually don't print more than 300 or 400 copies of a catalog. And those are numbers that, you know, most traditional printers wouldn't want to touch.
Yeah,
especially if you're doing color imagery. So there were technological limitations that sort of forced booksellers down the road of mimeograph and ditto into a sort of DIY world. And then, of course, the more well-heeled booksellers who could afford to produce fancy, well-formatted, nicely printed and bound catalogs could do so because the books they were selling and their overall operation could support it.
I mean, the other thing too is that it's also a function of the value of the books that are in the catalog. In other words, if you've got a million bucks worth of books in there, well, you can afford to spend a bit more on the way it looks, right?
Absolutely. And the, you know, some of the most sort of sumptuous, gorgeous catalogs I've ever seen come from dealers. There's one in particular I'm thinking of, but the dealers who deal in medieval manuscripts and things like that, where the, you know, all of the items are 5 and 6 figure items. And so, yeah, and sometimes 7 figure items. So the expense of producing a fantastic, you know, full color, beautifully bound catalog, it's probably a smaller percentage of the overall cost of that catalog than my printing my much less expensive catalogs would be for them. So there's a
Don, sorry, some guy just started using a chainsaw outside. So I'm just going to close the window. I'll be a second. Okay, there we go.
So in talking about the sort of simple form catalogs, I do want to make the point that the textual content of the simple form catalogs is not necessarily simple. I think there were a lot of catalogs that were simple, but that there were, that the booksellers could still do a range of things. It's just that this, you know, it's the print, this is the way it was printed, bound, and distributed as a rather simple item. For a point of comparison, I printed out a very recent catalog from Michael Ginsberg Books in Northeastern Massachusetts, who's an Americana specialist. And this catalog actually arrived as a PDF via email. It is a simple, straightforward list of items, but the descriptions are lengthier. The context into which Michael has put the items is deeper. There's more information about condition. Interestingly, he doesn't number his items, which I there are times when I wish I didn't number mine, but I feel like my clients would shoot me if I didn't number my items. But
you mean having an inventory number on them, you mean?
Just a catalog number, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4. And it's because when I send out a list now, I get these things back that, you know, people have to be fast now. It's not, you know, the mail is not a part of the, you know, it's shipping the book out. But for the most part, the mail has nothing to do with placing an order. You know, you have to place that order immediately or it's gone.
Yeah.
So to be able to send me an email that says I'd like numbers 3, 7, and 12 is a lot easier than writing out the names.
Yeah.
But there's another catalog that I have in front of me, which I really like because it shows me that people were trying to like push the edge of the way a bookseller defines the material they sell much earlier than I would have expected. We were talking about these short descriptions, how there were sort of economic reasons as part of it, but also like collector expectations. And I think that bookselling changes, it's always in some form changing, but I think that the types of things that people choose to sell and the types of things people choose to collect goes through these sort of abrupt changes every once in a while. And we're in the middle of one of those periods now. But, you know, there are periods where people, you know, try to stake out new ground.
Where are we now, Don? What are you talking about?
I think we're going to talk about content deeper a little bit later, but I want to just use this one example and I'll come back to it later. But this is a catalog from a dealer I've never heard of, and it's called El Cascajero, the old Spanish book mine. And it's a P.O. box number, box 285, Madison Square Station, New York. And this was a catalog from 1956. It's only 4 pages long. So it's both sides of a single sheet of paper folded once. It's titled Ideology. It's got this sort of aggressive typeface for the title. The rest of it is just very standard typewriter. It's not mimeograph, but it's another photo duplication process. And this is a catalog of books on various systems, beliefs, complaints, generalizations, observations, adumbrations, critiques, etc., etc. And it's, you know, this is kind of a hipster catalog from 1956, though. And I would love to buy a copy of Norbert Wiener's Cybernetics, the first edition, for $2.50.
Right. The thing about this catalog and the ones you've been talking about, it really is all about the content. I mean, we're not buying them because they're particularly attractive, right?
That's right. I mean, we buy them because they have information and we use the information in different ways, whether it's to inform the rest of our collecting. I mean, obviously the first reason is to find a book we want to purchase. Second reason is to inform the rest of our collecting. The third reason might be because one is interested in a historical manner about the idea of the book trade and the transformations in the book trade over time, the development of certain types of ideas, or perhaps just a single firm. Somebody finds that there's a single bookseller's work that is exciting for some reason, and they start collecting them. We're sort of jumping ahead a bit here, but one of the first firms whose catalogs I really, really followed closely was the firm of Ex Libris in New York, which was a pioneer in the selling of historical avant-garde materials in America.
Now, did they have images that appealed to you, or was it just the content?
The books were illustrated, but they were mostly illustrated as information.
What about the catalog, though?
The catalogs were really interesting. They varied in format from catalog to catalog, and there were a lot of like smaller special catalogs on subsections. You know, there's a small one on Bauhaus typography or avant-garde dance.
But did they show images or not?
Yes, they had images, but the images were fairly simple, but the catalogs were still laid out in a sort of dynamic, interesting way for me. The text on the page and the content was very deep. That still to this day, the cataloging, the descriptions of items in those catalogs are often the best that exists. The definitive descriptions of very rare avant-garde printed items, books and ephemera and whatnot, that those descriptions still stand as some of the best ever written. And there's another reason to be interested in these catalogs, the catalogs of Ex Libris, and that's that many of them, the text was written by the novelist Paul Auster, who worked for them when he was a young man and cataloged. And if you are interested in collecting literature and Paul Auster is amongst your collecting interests, then there are more than a handful of Ex Libris catalogs that are in the bibliography of Paul Auster's work.
Let's stay with design though, okay?
Sure.
So we've got a catalog that really there is no design. Then we move to black and white with limited design. Again, though, they're mostly functional, right?
Yeah, I think they're largely functional. I mean, any bookseller who spends any time thinking about the design and materials of their catalog knows that they're projecting their brand. Maybe that word wasn't being used 100 years ago, but they knew that they were putting it out there as a representation of themselves. And so, you know, booksellers would aspire to projecting different things. And you can see that in the physical books themselves. You know, you look at the catalogs of a company like Mags, well over 1,000 catalogs.
Yes, I've got catalog 898 and 842, and they're digest size.
Yep.
Again, the typography is very, very nice. The name of the author is in capitals. They've got some limited number of glossy black and white images, but not very many at all of the books.
The glossy images is just worth noting that those are on a different type of paper and inserted into the book as it's being bound. And that's because the production of those black and white images would not happen on the same press at the same time as the text, which of course now we take that for granted. And that was with black and white images. With color images, it wasn't until the late 1960s that one really saw color images just integrated into the book, into regular books, no less bookseller catalogs.
Look what I just found, actually. There's a big pullout on it.
There you go. That cost a little extra.
Yeah, that was a surprise.
The one I have in front of me is interesting. It's this is the Quaritch, not Mags. 100th anniversary catalog, and this was in 1947. Of course, the material is quite special. And there's one other mark in the book that of this centenary catalog, 100 copies have been printed on large paper. So they produced a finer version of this by changing the paper, perhaps having them a different binding put on them.
Like a limited edition.
Probably for their most special customers.
And so they are appealing with their catalog to the collector.
Yes. And by using forms the collector is very familiar with, the limited edition, you know, they have a very clear, consistent look. And we're talking, we're sort of bouncing back and forth between two dealers here, but the same Mags and Quaritch both have, through their history, you can put all of their catalogs on shelves. It takes up a lot of room and you can see consistency. It's rare. I have only three catalogs that have the same size. Mine are all
right
over the place.
Right.
Because that's the way I am.
And this does fit in with design. And I had this discussion with Jonathan Hill. All of his catalogs are digest size.
Yes.
All of them. And also, and again, we're going to talk about her a bit later, but Heather O'Donnell's beautiful little digest size catalogs, they're all the same size, and they look lovely on the shelf together.
They do, and I have a good deal to say about those. And there's another dealer I'll mention here whose book selling I'm constantly impressed by, and
yeah,
that's Ben Kinmont. One of the reasons I'm so impressed by him, and this is just one of many, is that his catalog sort of arrived fully formed. You know, his first catalog has a specific design on the page, the typography, the typefaces, the size, the type of paper and the thickness, the type of wrapper and the thickness, the way it's indicated on the spine. He's changed the color of the wrappers and has adopted some patterned wrappers. I'll say halfway through his 20 plus years of these catalogs. And I think we're now in around 15 of them. I have a full set in the office and a partial set here, but they're exactly the same size. They're uniform. Some of them are slightly thicker than others, but there's something about like knowing that this is what you want your catalogs to look like. Of course, Ben worked for Jonathan Hill, so I'm sure.
I didn't know that.
He had the advantage of seeing the benefits of continuity and good planning and good design, whereas I started out with some crummy staple thing I made at Kinko's and then learned from there. And I'm still only halfway there.
Well, you know, the other thing too, again, that does appeal to the collector, you know, getting the full series and the series having a uniform look. So there is that thinking behind it as well, I think.
And within his catalogs and you know, and many others too, but within, in particular in Ben's catalogs, there are all sorts of little nods to historical book production. The colophon he has a little epigram that's attached to his press that appears in every volume. He's named a press. It's not just Ben Kinmont Bookseller. It's Antinomian Press, and you know, producing the work of Ben Kinmont Bookseller. So, and there are layers of complexity that I think really please collectors and are intriguing and make the whole process of receiving one of his books and sitting and reading it a pleasure.
Yeah. Okay. So we're moving into the next category, unless there's anything you want to say about the black and white limited design that we haven't said. But the next category we've decided upon is what we call a classically beautiful design, where the design is really appropriate to the topic. So examples from some of those that I have are, again, Jonathan's catalogs and Glenn Horowitz's catalogs. And Glenn's are, again, all over the map. But they both primarily were designed by Jerry Kelly, who's like the giant in the field, I think.
That's right. And you know, Jerry is, I think he's one of the go-to people for printing catalogs that have a consistent feel. I think if I get a catalog and it was designed by Jerry Kelly, I can tell that was the case before halfway out of the envelope.
I'll just give you an example. Like I'm looking at, here's James Joyce.
Right.
And this is a collection of James Joyce's books and manuscripts by Glenn Horowitz from 1996. And it's, you can see the gold foil and the beautiful textured thick hard cover. And I was looking at another catalog that I had, and it looked quite similar. And it's from Jaffe and Lame Duck.
Right.
And here it is here.
Yep, that's right.
Your name is in there, Don.
Yeah, I think I'm in that one somewhere.
You are.
If it's probably just to say that I'm responsible for any errors.
Yes, that's right. You made all the errors. That's what it says in here.
When I was in the employ of one of those two, we would kind of go back and forth between designing our own catalogs and having Jerry Kelly design them, and it's absolutely clear which ones are which looking back on them.
I just love owning this. It's just so exquisitely classy.
Yeah, they project a certain, I don't want to say time period, but a certain sort of place within the mind of the history of the book. Illustrations are usually either simple, mostly black and white. Occasionally there's a color insert or something in the catalogs I've worked on.
These are mostly color images in this one here.
They went a little extra on that one. It's still a very traditional type of catalog. There's also Scott Vial of the Essentius Press here in Maine also does work like that. He actually produced some of the early Ben Kinmont catalogs.
Okay.
And by the way, I would put Ben in this category of these sort of really beautifully produced, but classical and appropriate to the tradition of antiquarian bookselling.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean I don't love the inappropriate to tradition booksellers catalogs as well. But Jonathan's catalogs are always are that consistent size, whereas to use the opposite example, Glenn's catalogs, but also produced by Jerry Kelly, those sort of change a great deal depending on the nature of the catalog he's doing.
I'll show you one here. So we saw the one with the gold foil, the beautiful sort of solid classic. Not banker, but you know what I mean, really rich, deep-pocketed kind of feel to it. But this is a designer's archive. This is Philip Grishkin, the dust jacket designer. And it's completely different, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a good example of a bookseller's catalog that's really for a single item those are not items that are for sale individually.
That's getting into content, but yeah.
Well, but it's an interesting point that these catalogs exist, having only been produced to advertise a single collection or a single object, and they continue to be produced. I know of some quite recent examples that were very privately produced and sent to special clients. I have another catalog that was done by Jerry Kelly for Glenn Horowitz, and this was a collection. It's called Against the Tide. And it was a collection of African Americana. So here, this is the cover, which has a reproduction of a woodcut title page and frontispiece with Frederick Douglass. And this is also a catalog where the bookseller has employed an outside Randy Weinstein, but also Henry Louis Gates Jr. wrote a foreword to the catalog. So the idea that one would bring in knowledgeable scholars from outside of the specific bookselling operation to write an introduction or a preface or something that's another thing that we see in catalogs. I think it's really interesting. And for people collecting the bibliographies of certain authors, some of their work appears in bookselling catalogs and they may not even know that as introductions, as historical overviews.
Yeah. And again, this is into the content side, but, that particular catalog had quite an impact on the way those books by African Americans and about them were received in the marketplace. They put a whole new value on them, didn't they? Didn't it?
Yeah, that catalog. I mean, it certainly had an impact on the price evaluations of books in that field. There were other factors that were coming along at that time. The very famous annual African Americana sales at Swan started somewhere right around then. They also brought in an outside scholar to assist with the cataloging, who sort of runs those auctions for them. I talked about booksellers sort of projecting themselves outward, putting their brand into the marketplace, a small marketplace as it is. One of the ways they do that is by almost declaring ownership of certain fields or certain types of certain authors by putting out an incredibly thorough, detailed catalog of just Bapho material. I mean, that James Joyce catalog you showed is a good example of that. And there's some other catalogs that somehow I missed these for years. Heritage Bookshop, which was just a landmark in Los Angeles for ages.
Yeah, they put out all sorts of different shapes and sizes and styles, all sorts.
They produced a series of books in the early 90s, which were bibliographical catalogs, but based on collections that they were selling of major authors. And this is one they did for the Bronte sisters.
Oh, yeah.
And this is one they did for Trollope.
These are hardcover, right?
These were hardbound, beautifully produced books designed and illustrated with appendices and all sorts of technical apparatus.
They were like books. They are books.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. These are, if one is looking for a Trollope bibliography, there are a couple, and this is amongst them. It is not, yeah. This is not considered a different animal. And actually, this was published in 2002. I guess the other one, the Bronte sister, was the 90s. But by putting these books out in this large, very beautifully designed, illustrated form, this let the collecting world know that if you're buying material, you would want to go to them for these sort of, you know, major 19th century authors. But also, if you were selling, that these were people that were serious and that, you know, you would want to go to them to sell your collection. The physical book tells people that these guys are real in this field and should be, you know, the first stop for you.
Yeah, well, a beautiful hardcover book as a catalog, is that says something, doesn't it?
Yeah, I'm going to say something, you know, that sort of creates the bridge, I think, between that and where we may be going with this conversation. But those books that were produced by Heritage were able to be produced the way they were because technology changed. Yeah. So, you know, there were word processing and certain types of layout design software was available that sped up part of the process. Printing technology has gone through a huge revolution, which allows people to produce smaller quantities of very well-produced books, very nicely produced and illustrated. And
affordably.
Affordably produced. And as an example of that is John Wendell's William Blake catalog number 46, which came out in 2009. And this catalog is still a fairly simple, largely black and white interior, but there are black and white illustrations and a handful of color illustrations and this beautiful color cover. And he's also included a CD-ROM in the rear of the catalog in order to give you a full selection of the color illustrations of the items in the catalog. Even if color illustration was inexpensive, it would take up a huge amount of room to illustrate all the items, but he could do it with this. This is a technology that librarians know how to deal with, but it's a very small moment in time where people were producing catalogs on CD-ROM that had CD-ROM extras. Now, of course, do we have something to play them on? My laptop no longer has a CD-ROM player in it.
Yeah.
I have an external one because I need it. You know, that's a little piece of technology that's related to color printing that we've now gone beyond because the color printing is now less expensive as well. So the technology affected the growth and change in bookseller catalogs as well.
Okay. Anything else on classically a beautiful design?
Oh my gosh. Oh, there's so many.
Well, we've covered some pretty important ones. That's the idea though, that in terms of separating and categorizing the wide variety of catalogs that are out there, that this is a category. The final one that we're going to look at is a spectacular one. Maybe you could talk about that.
This is basically, you know, catalogs that it's sort of where I think we are at the moment and have been for about 5 or 6 years or so with the bookseller catalog. What is changing the most? I think that we've gotten to this moment because we went through a period where everything was getting easy because of the digital world, like I just described. You know, that it was easier to have color printing. It was easier to just send a PDF. And it was easier to have, you know, illustrations, multiple illustrations and the like. But there was a change going on in bookselling, which was, I believe, was really accelerated by the sort of fear of the digital book. You know, there was a period of maybe 15 years. I mean, you know, it was bad enough that we had to freak out about Amazon and eBay and whatnot, and then learn to live with them. And then the digital book, Kindle in particular, but other things made people start freaking out. And it took booksellers a while to realize that that has nothing to do with the antiquarian book trade. That there have always been, you know, I could buy a $1 copy of The Great Gatsby in 10 minutes. And I live out in the country, but that the $1 copy of Great Gatsby doesn't affect the $200,000 plus copy of The Great Gatsby in a Beautiful Dust Jacket that sells at the New York Fair every April or whatever. So booksellers sort of got comfortable once again with the fact that we're selling material objects. We're selling books as artifacts, yes, as information. But it's the information that's printed in the book plus the information of the material object itself.
And it's much more than just information.
Yes, it's it's text plus, depending on the book and the nature of it. I mean, I deal with very often very humble books. I like all kinds of cookbooks, and I've sold some big royal cookbooks over the years. But I also deal with a lot of community cookbooks and church cookbooks. Those are very simple, humble objects. If you're looking for recipes, great. But you can find lots of recipes in lots of places.
Yeah, you can have them on eBooks.
Yeah, on eBooks, you can get them, you can download them online. You can look at all sorts of other sources of recipes online if that's what you need. And I do that myself. But the material objects of the community cookbooks for me is something that just drives me into a totally different understanding of what these objects have, what information about society and culture they convey to us, and why it is I want to spend my days examining them.
Is it because of marginalia, for example, or what?
Well, that's one thing. I mean, cookbooks in particular, and this is a totally off our topic, but I'll stick with community cookbooks because it illustrates this idea best. But the community cookbooks are produced a lot like bookseller catalogs outside of traditional publishing.
Right.
They're produced by people who are like, I'm going to make a book.
Yeah, they're self-published, aren't they?
Most. There's a range. But over the course of the 150 years of the history of community cookbooks in America and elsewhere, you see the people who produce them go through different steps to create the content, to fund it.
Well, what I was talking about was bookseller catalogs. They're self-published.
Exactly. And that's the only reason I went off here is it's the group that decides, whether it's a group of church ladies or hospital auxiliary or whatever it is, they need to come to terms with how the book is going to be physically produced, how the text will be assembled, how the book will be physically produced, and how it will be distributed. And that's the same for any book. Those are the concerns anybody making a book would have.
Right.
So when it comes to bring it back to bookseller catalogs, the bookseller catalogs have the same concerns, the same economic pressures, the same technological limitations, depending on what moment we're talking about. And of course, nowadays, those technological limitations are getting fewer and fewer because, you know, you can produce very small numbers of very nicely produced books.
You were suggesting then that there was this renewed appreciation for the physical book.
Right.
That manifests itself.
You know, this is in addition to what I just said. It's that the bookseller catalogs of the last 5 to 10 years have started due to these changes in ideas about books, due to the technological advances that allow more flexibility, and also due to a thankfully growing group of new younger booksellers who are bringing new ideas about the books they sell into the trade. And so the physical catalogs are all of a sudden becoming representative of those changes. And so to talk about a couple of them, you brought up Honey and Wax.
Yeah.
Heather. And Honey and Wax has produced, I've got at least 9, but there may be 10. These catalogs are very interesting. When they started, it was Heather O'Donnell and Rebecca Bowman. What did I just say?
I'm not sure.
So Heather and Rebecca put these together, they are a perfect, to me, a perfect illustration of how they're placing the book through its, here you can see here. So this is a single page spread from catalog number 4. And, right, you know, where traditionally the books would have been placed on a flat background. Oh, I love that cover because I sold them that book.
Did you?
Yeah, I did.
I'm going to get you to sign this copy as well.
I bought it in Hamburg in like 2000, and it's about 4 feet or 3 feet long, and I had to get it back through the airport. It was one of those dumb things when you're traveling and you buy a book that's too big to put in your suitcase. But to go back to their catalogs,
yeah,
they produce photographs using professional photographers. They're not doing it themselves like me, where the book is placed into what would be called an editorial context. It's, you know, the book is placed on a surface. There are other objects around. The book isn't necessarily even centered in the photograph. It's sometimes you only get a detail. This isn't how they might illustrate these books on their, like on a website, for example, because there they would want all the information so you could see clearly all of it. But they're trying to make you feel the physicality of the book. Like, look at this beautiful printed page from the 19th century or the 17th century. You can see the physicality of the leather binding. You can see the way it sits on a shelf. There's another page spread in catalog 4 of I don't know whether it's all the books in the catalog, but it's a lot of books in the catalog.
Yeah.
Some of them are standing. Some of them are opened up in an accordion fold thing. Yeah. Others are happily next to each other in sets. But it also gives the clients or potential clients an idea of how one lives with rare books.
There's in that same catalog, there's a close-up portrait of Thomas Hobbes.
Yes.
And you can see the foxing on the paper. So it, as you say, it really gets you close up to the book.
And the other thing I'll say is, like, as we talked about before, these catalogs are, we talked about this with other dealers, these catalogs are uniform in size. The sort of typography they use throughout is uniform. They're very nicely designed, but they also have like very graphic covers that do vary a good deal. But the size, the materials, the typography stays the same. This is that sort of consistency, but with a different sort of aesthetic about the material that they're depicting. There are lots of other booksellers I could say similar things about. This one in particular is one of my favorites, which is, in a way, these are the most effective example of what we're talking about here. And these are the catalogs of Simon Beatty, a British bookseller. And these catalogs, which he's now, I don't know what number he's up to, you know, 6 or more. This is copy number 6. They arrive folded like this. They're sort of like it's like a tabloid size. It's not a broadsheet. It's like a tabloid size newspaper. It's printed on quite thin paper, but in, there's number one. Yep. But in full color. And you can see that he's laid the books out on these backgrounds and that the imagery is separate, is used as a background, and then the text is set into it. I don't know whether it was catalog 1 and 2 or just 1, but it won a national design award in Great Britain, not for bookseller catalogs, but for like commercial design.
You know, one thing that's striking is that the books are larger than life.
Yes.
They're huge, and they're, again, we talk about being close up to the physical object. It's quite spectacular.
Well, you know, you mentioned that Jonathan Hill has chosen that they're all digest size, sort of an octavo sized paperback, all quite, mostly quite thick. This is sort of the opposite. These are very thin, folded in half, but very large pages. It's almost like, you know, to read them, you have to work. You have to sit down somewhere where there's not a computer right in front of you. And lean back and flip through the pages and enjoy it. But it's almost like the physical act of reading his catalogs, it's just a reminder of what the pleasure of the physical book is. You know, it's not the handiest object to be working with. It's not the handiest object to keep on your shelf, but it had a real impact. And the, you know, everything from the size, the type of paper, the way he uses the illustrations within the catalog, but also the types of pictures that are taken of again, emphasizing the physical aspects of the book. It's
The other thing too is they really stood out on the librarian's desk too. Like librarians are thinking, well, how am I going to file this, you know? But it's really a presence in their office, isn't it?
It is. And I think I could imagine some catalogs arriving that would be a nuisance for a client, a collector, or a librarian. But I think in the case of Simons, his material is so great, and his descriptions, and I actually don't believe I've ever purchased something from Simon. And I think that's only because I don't see much material that overlaps with my field. But I want to spend time with his catalogs when they arrive. And, you know, there's some people who you want to read their catalog because you might, you know, there's a reasonably good chance of finding something to purchase. There are others you want to read them because, you know, there are fields I don't know anything about, or I'm not, you know, it's not part of my normal life, but I can read these catalogs and learn something that I enjoy. Or you just read them because they're pure pleasure. And I would put, for me, I'd put Simons in that last category.
Yes. Rebecca went on to form Type Punch Matrix with her partner. And I think this might be their first.
That is. That's their first. And I have it as well right here. And I think you can see the, they're not the same, but there is continuity in terms of the way that they display the books. The books are put into environments. She also tends to have an image of a book that you can definitely tell it's a three-dimensional, you know, it's a picture of the book in a three-dimensional space, not just a flat thing. Some, you know, close-up detail of an illustration or a piece of the binding or a typography.
Plus it's a riot of color, isn't it?
Yes. And this is a content thing to notice here, but I'd point out that Honey and Wax and Type Punch Matrix and Simon Beatty, they're not specialists in a single field. They all come from working from dealers that you know, dealt in big books for big collectors.
And Bauman's.
That's one of them. And there are some others for Simon, but the stuff they're selling is not sort of like recognizable blue chip books. But yes, they are marketing it to people who want to sort of have a broader sense of what they might want to collect. And they want the beautiful presentation. They want the excellent service, which I know all of these people are very, very concerned about. But the books themselves are not easily, they're not books that everybody knows. So they're taking things that are lesser known and putting them into an important new context. And you know, I think that's how you create new collectors, is to show people stuff they'd never thought of before and turn them onto it.
Yeah. And there's a kind of a wow factor that they're introducing with the presentation, but they're also telling these really interesting stories about lots of books that haven't traditionally been sold that way.
Yeah, that's right.
Here's another one, Don, that you put me on to.
Yep.
This takes your breath away. Mark Funka?
Yeah, it's Funka or Funka, who's a fairly new dealer, but someone who's been collecting a while, who splits his time between the Pacific Northwest and Berlin. He's an interesting guy. He's got interests all over the map. He's got two catalogs out now. This is does yours have a jigsaw puzzle on the cover?
Yes, one has a jigsaw puzzle, but look at this. It takes your breath away.
Right, and that is supposed to make you pay attention to the fact that books can have these things within them that you can just sit and stare at and study and enjoy. And I think that's part of the, you know, of what these folks and others and occasionally me are trying to do with our books, is to have people go, oh, you know, that's really interesting. And I'm my good bookselling friend, Garrett Scott, who's produced some catalogs and many, many, many shortlists. You know, one of his specialties is another thing I come across a lot in the cookbook world, which is books that have sort of a vernacular incursion on them somehow, that there's new, you know, that somebody repaired it roughly almost in the wild. It's not done by a professional binder. Sometimes they're called Frankenbooks.
And
for generations, people have looked at those books and shrugged and said, oh, it's busted. Let's go find a good copy. What Garrett has shown by like focusing on that little piece is that the that weird shoelace that was used to sew a book back together with a hammer and an awl, roughly, you know, and that thus the phrase Frankenbook, that's a piece of beauty in material culture and of history.
He presents it with visuals.
But he's also but he's not so tied to the printed catalog. Otherwise we would be talking about that more here.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, these catalogs from Mark are, like, you open it up and it's almost like you want to fall into it. It's so incredible.
Well, you'll also notice, flipping through, the amount of image to text is, there's a lot more imagery in here. And it's all, you know, full color imagery than there is text. There are many pages and facing pages which have zero text on them, or just a little inset. His books, by the way, like, you know, we mentioned Honey and Wax, Tide Punch Matrix, like Simon Beatty, also sort of all over the road. It's not about a single subject area. It's about engaging, exciting objects from throughout the world of books, and in the case of Mark, a lot of interesting ephemera as well.
Okay, well, speaking of text to graphics or images, let's move into the content side then.
There's a little bit more here, though. This is where we really go outside in terms of the format.
So, oh, yes. Okay.
Just start with the catalogs of Biblioctopus.
But that's about content too, though, Don, because the content is so wonderfully wry.
Well, yeah, and we can go back to that. But there's something else going on with them about the form. And which is itself wry. So we talked about, you know, with the Jerry Kelly design books, that those, you know, those have a classical influence that we can, you know, when we hold them, we sort of feel like we're connected to this tradition of book collecting. And then these more modern books like the Honey and Wax and Type Punch Matrix and Simon's catalogs, that those are, you know, in their production, but also in the way they're illustrated, that those are sort of focusing on the materiality. What Biblioctopus has done with the whole series that they've done over the last, you know, decade or more, and Biblioctopus is a kind of classic, oh gosh, I never know the best term to use for them. I like to think of them as, you know, it's part of the carriage trade. I'm not sure.
What do you mean by that?
They deal in a lot of books that are fairly well-known material, you know, the best copies they can find, that it could be anything from Isaac Newton to Faulkner to, you know, Martin Luther King. I mean, it could, you know, it could be almost anything, but it's going to be fairly recognizable material.
Right.
They're not going down the rabbit hole of weird books. But they've stepped outside the sort of classical look and have a whole series of these catalogs that have been bound in these crazy sort of op art covers, that each one has a different sort of pattern of silver that reflects light in odd ways. And then they printed the name here is physically, it's debossed onto the cover. But they also have, I'm going to call it the half title, even though it's not. And each half title has one little thing. I'm going to hold this right up close. And you open it and it says, it's got that little circly star thing that your iPhone has, and it says loading.
Yes.
And another one of theirs, you open it and it says slide to unlock, and it's got the little icon that you, again, from your iPhone.
Right. It's just clever. It's fun, and it's clever.
It's clever, but it's also reminding you of the physical difference between the electronic on the real book. It's right. Fun, and it makes you laugh, but it's also specifically there in order to make you say, oh wait, these are not the same thing. I'm entering this other world, and whether I enter it through a printed object like this or I enter it through browsing on my iPhone, what's in that world is real material stuff you can handle and touch, and I hate to say smell, Yes, it's real. And I think that that is a fantastic way to use the design of a book to create the context in which you sell the material.
It's kind of meta, isn't it?
It's very meta. And to go even more meta. So a bookseller whose catalogs I've always admired and enjoyed reading is Simon Finch. Simon was somebody who, he was really the second person. The first person was my sometime business partner, Jan Vanderdonk, who had a gallery in New York that did books and works on paper. But Simon was the second person that showed me that a bookseller's shop could look like something other than a mess.
I like the mess, though.
I like the mess, too. And my place is a mess. But I always wondered why, you know, your average shoe store selling low-end shoes, not fancy shoes, just spends more time like thinking about the way they present the material than almost any bookseller anywhere. And they certainly don't go to great lengths to create a really special atmosphere. And Simon was the first person I was aware of who really broke that. And not only did he make a space that was great, he made different spaces for different types of books. So he had one shop that was very traditional. He had another shop in Notting Hill that was extremely modern. It was designed by a hotshot architect and had no square walls. All the walls were round and the books were in these sort of weird plastic alcoves and things. Very small shop, but selling very modern stuff. And he had a different shop that sold photography material, and that had a different aesthetic to it. So he was interested in the sort of architectural aspects of merchandising, of selling. And that sort of idea also showed up in his catalogs. And the one I really love the most is one, it was a Simon Finch Rare Books Catalog 40. It was called Unchained Simon Finch. And have you seen this one?
You sent me a copy.
Oh, good. I sent you a copy. Good.
I'm so happy. Yeah. And yeah. I haven't read much of B.S. Johnson, but that's what this was all based on, right? There's a good biography that I read most of him called The Elephants or something. But anyway.
Well, I mean, it's basically an unbound book. It has a belly band, which is a physical aspect of a book we don't think about too much, but we probably see them pretty frequently, a printed belly band describing the idea for this catalog, but also that this catalog was made for that Notting Hill shop that I described to you. It was made for the ultra modern small shop that had 40 items in it and no square walls, as opposed to his Maddox Street shop, which was very traditional. But it's all in a sort of clamshell box with a printed, a color printed paper wrapper over the top of it. You know,
with with photographs of John Lennon and Joyce and Nietzsche and Hemingway. Yeah.
He's got some traditional stuff in there and he's got some very untraditional stuff in there. Now, this catalog is also 22 years old. You know, this catalog was done in 1999. He was really kind of pushing the form of what the catalog could be.
He took B.S. Johnson's idea, basically. That was one of his books. It's up to you to figure out what you want from it.
That's right. And you could assemble it any way you want. There's also I think it also is a bit of a nod to John Cage and Ideas of Chance that you could, you could read these things in whatever order, because each signature was a separate thing with the illustration and text. So it enabled you to build, as you were saying with B.S. Johnson, to build your own catalog in the order you might wish to experience it. So it's a little bit of postmodernism or at least deconstruction.
Yeah, I was going to say that biography of B.S. Johnson is by Jonathan Coe, and it's worth reading.
Ah, okay.
But anyway, sorry, interrupted.
But I'm going to go one step further than that. I showed you that catalog that had CD-ROM in it before. The CD-ROM, of course, is both fantastic because it adds all this extra illustration to the catalog, but it's also problematic because the format may disappear. And we now know, we were told that they last forever, but we now know that they decay at rates certainly much faster than books. I wonder whether librarians are aware that there are CD-ROMs in some of these booksellers' catalogs. I know their librarians work to conserve and move the data to new formats. Yeah. But these bookseller catalogs may not be on their radar.
Incidentally, they're not. Cars don't come with CD players anymore.
My truck is 4 years old, and it's I think it was the last one that had one. Yeah, and I know that when I get a new one, it's going to be missing. Actually, more stable than a CD-ROM, the cassette tape, or the K7, as I learned it was called in the music industry. This is a catalog. It's called Art by Tape, Not by Nam June Paik, and that's referring to the conceptual artist Nam June Paik. And it's a catalog by the conceptual art book dealer Steven Lieber, who sadly passed away a few years ago. And Steven Lieber's catalogs were frequently riffing on the work of different conceptual artists. And the catalog itself is printed in, it is the liner notes.
Okay.
but it's great. You also do need to listen to the tape in order to understand the catalog.
So what does he do? Does he read it out?
No, he's not reading it out. It's a separate piece of text. He used other conceptual artists' ideas. It was never clear to me whether those artists were sometimes actually involved in the creation of these things, because he knew most of these people. There's another one I have somewhere that is it's printed on newsprint, and it folds down to a small size, and then it opens up into a poster of Stripes by Daniel Baran. I think that's probably was a Daniel Baran piece, but I need to find out. Interestingly, Jonathan Hill, who I think of as in style a conservative bookseller in style, yeah, is a huge fan of Steven Lieber's catalogs, and occasionally his catalogs show up in Jonathan's catalogs for sale. It's an odd format. It's forcing you to experience the catalog in a completely different manner. Interestingly, other booksellers are now describing them in their catalog.
You know, Don, what's kind of sad here is that rare book libraries are dumping bookseller catalogs like you wouldn't believe.
Yes, absolutely. You know, the good news is that there is a depository of booksellers' catalogs at the Grolier Club, and that recently another large collection, which was, I don't know if it was ever in danger of being dumped, but it was no longer wanted by another institution, that made its way to join the other catalogs at the Grolier Club. I don't know the answer to this, but you know, one of my concerns is that the Grolier Club has a very specific mission. I don't know whether the type of digitization and things like that that one finds at other major research institutions would be available to these catalogs. And, you know, where would the funding for that come from? Whereas within other larger institutions, that's happening on a regular basis. You know, this is kind of a good segue here to talk further about content, but, you know, there is a lot of primary research that's done in the best catalogs. Now, I say the best, and that's not completely fair, because I think there are great catalogs that have no primary research in them. But there are catalogs of people, you know, I think Jonathan Hill is a great example in the classical tradition of booksellers, where the descriptions of many of the books he has in those catalogs, and these are true antiquarian books. These are very early books on the fields of medicine and history of science and the great humanistic fields. The detail of information he has about those books is the best people will ever write about single specific issues of these authors' works.
Well, I've got four. There are five in total.
This is Catalogus Catalogorum number 3, which I don't think you have there.
No, I don't. I think that you're going to have to give that to. No, I've got 3. This
3?
One?
Oh, yeah, that's it. You got it. Okay, good. Now
I have to see here which one I'm missing. I think it might be, I'm not sure which one. But anyway, combined, they give you an incredible resource, don't they, of a bibliography?
They do. And I, in preparing for our talk, I pulled catalogs from a bunch of different places. I have 2 pallets of catalogs in the storeroom at my office, many of which came from a single collector who was a serious collector of books on food and drink. And he had a lot of English and European continental catalogs that I didn't have that were food and drink related. But he also had all of the catalogs of that were, you know, just people who dealt in older books. And those catalogs contain one or five or six books on food and drink. So he had all of those. And the idea that there's no way to sort of know that those would contain those things, except that he had them and he had an index card system to be able to figure out what was in which book, what book was in which catalog. I don't know if it'll ever be on the wall for me so I can easily use it. The best of the catalogs are, but there's still another palette and a half of them. Anyway, okay. When I was going looking for the books to talk about, I also quickly went through, I have one reference collection here and another one in the office. And the collection here is more about the history of the book in general, the history of collecting and the idea of the book over time. So there's, you know, there's a shelf of books on paper, and in the middle of it is Oak Knoll's catalog of paper history and technique, which is, you know, for me, I go back looking for something on a very specific thing. It's quicker often than going through library records, although it's only as complete as it is as a bookseller catalog, but I still find it very useful. There was another one that Charles B. Wood, somebody I should have mentioned in terms of the sort of classical form of his books, but this was a pair of catalogs he did, catalog 82 and parts 1 and 2 on book arts and printing history. So that's, you know, that's in the printing history part of that collection.
Here, look what I got.
And that's his books on early photographic books, to talk about another aspect of content. I've got 5 or 6 of those upstairs on the shelf.
Of this particular one?
Of that catalog, yeah.
You're not making me feel very good, Don.
Oh, I'm sorry. You know, I don't have a lot of books on modern literature.
No.
I like to read it, but I don't.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, what you're talking about there is the scholarly content. Is that correct?
Yes and no. When I think about the scholarly content, I think about somebody who's looking at material that maybe hasn't gotten a full treatment.
With its own bibliography, you mean?
Yeah, with its own bibliography, or frankly, that the bibliographies aren't that good. I mean, there are plenty of bibliographies that are useful to bring up the idea of a laundry list as content. You know, we talked about in design, we talked about those very simple typed things. This is kind of the content version of that, where it's just a laundry list of all the items they can think of.
Yeah.
And there are some famous bibliographies used in the art world and elsewhere that's really just like author, title, date. All you're doing is making sure that you got all the books that are in the such and such bibliography. You don't learn anything else. But in the scholarly bookseller catalogs, and this could be anything from, we talked about James Jaffe earlier because he uses Jerry Kelly so frequently, but he's done a number of catalogs on very specific subjects that I think are probably some of the best catalogs on the subject. So he had a catalog on the Tulsa School of Arts and Letters, another one on Black Mountain College, another one on Poets of the New York School. So these were like very focused on very specific parts of modern American literature that he's such an expert on, and that many of the descriptions in these books are amongst the most complete descriptions one could find. There's another whole level of complexity when one is looking at a 17th or 16th or 15th century book, like Jonathan Hill would be looking at. My own personal cataloging project is working with the American Community Cookbook to produce this, what still looks like it's a 6-volume catalog arranged by state that gives a sort of overview of the development of American community cookbooks in each state of the union.
Wow.
But also has a whole technical apparatus at the beginning that is missing from discussions of community cookbooks. You know, the definition of community cookbooks is still sort of batted around loosely, means different things to different people. It really shouldn't. There are all sorts of complexities in cataloging community cookbooks that we had to grapple with and come up with precision terms. And so we have a whole glossary that's defining terms that in the normal bookselling world would not be debatable terms, but here they are. So the catalog has to address that. And so that's the kind of scholarly sort of primary research stuff that really excites me. It could be on very modern material. It could be on very ancient material, but it's really like the first line of historical description of the books. The sort of knowing all the books in a field is certainly part of the scholarship, to be able to refer to a bibliography or a bookseller's catalog that has a kind of laundry list is still valuable, because it says, oh, here's a book on a subject you didn't know this book existed. Now I know, and I can go see if I can find it. It's right. Valuable, but the scholarly stuff is the stuff that, you know, where it takes three pages to catalog a book. That's my kind of scholarly catalog.
So we talked about the laundry list, which is basically, you know, what that bookseller may have on hand in stock that they think is worth putting in a catalog.
Yeah, I mean, it's on the one hand, there's just the here's what I got this week list,
yeah,
you know, or this yeah. month or whatever. And that's very traditional. I mean, those have been going on forever and they still go on. We see them on the e-version of that. And it's worth remembering that how many catalogs are produced these days only digitally. And they're still catalogs, but they have different challenges. There's the laundry list, and then there's the super scholarly, and then everything is in between.
Okay, so we've got a laundry list, we've got scholarly. The next category we've determined is pioneering a new field.
We talked before about how some booksellers were taking the design aspects of the book and pushing that into new directions and creating new experiences with the catalogs. This is sort of related, but not necessarily happening with the same booksellers, perhaps a little. And it's gone on forever, which is that a bookseller steps forward to say, this is stuff I think you need to pay attention to, whatever right. that might be.
And it's a bit like a collector too, isn't it? I mean, this is exactly what a collector would do, is identify something that they think is important and then go after it.
That's right. And I learned a good deal about that when I worked for John Renosky at Lame Duck back in the late 90s and early 2000s. And, you know, John had at various points and then during my time with him and afterwards, he would identify either fields of literature or history of ideas, mostly modern material, mostly late 19th century to current material. And he'd see it and he'd say, well, if a book by Ernest Hemingway is worth $50,000, then, you know, a book by Franz Kafka should be worth more than that. And for those of us who agree, it was exciting to see somebody recognize that some of these books hadn't. Franz Kafka was not a new thing. To take that and to push it into an area of book collecting where it traditionally wasn't really there. And so he would go out and find all the copies of Kafka that were interesting and, to his mind, and I would agree with him here, undervalued, and present them in a way that people would say, oh, this is important stuff. Now, frequently people would say, oh my God, these books are so incredibly expensive. They used to be, you know, a third of this price. But I can tell you that certainly in the case of Kafka, maybe not so much in the case of Kierkegaard, which was another favorite of his, but in the case of Kafka, the prices have held up and gone on from where the lines he drew. And so that's taking somebody that's perhaps undervalued, you know, under-collected amongst big collectors in America, and yeah. putting them in front of them. He did the same with Latin American literature, you know, really championing authors like Borges and Gabriel Garcia Marquez. He did it with French literature, which of course is much more widely known, but not so collected in America, and Russian literature and other things. I mentioned earlier that James Jaffe was taking catalog, you know, doing catalogs on things like the New York School of Poets or the Tulsa School, Black Mountain College. I mean, these are like fantastic eras in American literary and artistic history that were known by people in certain portions of the art world or by certain types of scholars, but they weren't really on the radar of too many collectors. And for someone, you know, with his knowledge to put those catalogs out, it helped to push these collections into create new avenues of collecting, new interests. Perhaps the most, and this is an interesting example of this, which I think had both positive and negative effects. Let me just reach and grab this. This is the Andrew Roth's Book of 101 books.
Yes, the photography, yes.
Photographic books. At the time that this came out, I was selling photographic books. To a large extent, this book pushed me out of that market. I stopped buying and selling photographic books because this book changed the market for those books. In no
you
way-
You couldn't afford to buy them anymore and sell them?
Well, there were two things happened. The prices skyrocketed and nobody wanted anything except the books in this book.
Crazy.
And that was a very, and I just want to point out that like this is, a lot of people don't know that this is an exhibition catalog. The books were exhibited, but they were also for sale. It is a bookseller catalog is what I really should be saying. And there was a different edition of this that was available for sale at the exhibition that would really be the more formal bookseller catalog. But that's where this book comes from. And what happened was it suddenly made people aware of collecting photographic books, but the only books they were aware of were the 101 books in this collection. And by the way, the guys who were collecting photographic books before this are all still around collecting photographic books. I don't know about the people who jumped in.
There's Parr, right?
Yeah, and that's what helped to break it all up again.
He went after stuff in Japan, for example, that no one even looked, that wasn't on this list.
There are three or four volumes now of his history of the photo book. As a photo book dealer who was selling before that, that's what we were all doing. We were looking at a much broader spectrum of stuff.
Yes.
And it's only because of the Roth 101 that all of a sudden all the pressure was on this 101 books, some of which are kind of scarce and some of which are exceedingly scarce. But it was all about this. And therefore, the other books that weren't in this list would sort of just sit around and nobody really cared. But Parr, with his multi-volume set, helped break it up. And I can't tell you another field of book collecting that has spawned so many descriptive histories of the books. So there's the Roth 101, there's the multi-volume Parr set, there's the Soviet photo book, the Dutch photo book, there are multiple volumes called the Japanese photo book, the Austrian photo book, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and I have, a dozen of them upstairs on my shelves, and each one of them is a monster like this or bigger. There's nothing like this in the cookbook world.
There you go. There you go, Don.
Well, no.
Wide open for you.
Yeah, there's one book and it's miserably awful. So there's room still. But
yeah. You know what that tells me, though? It's, the damn herd mentality. That's not how you collect. You go after what, you think is important, not what a damn list says.
Well, I mean, it's always gone in waves like that. Modern literature, collecting modern firsts got really, hot in the 80s, and it got hotter. And then people were collecting uncorrected proofs and ARCs, all the stuff that we now take for granted. And then they started collecting hypermoderns, which were like collecting the books the day they were issued as if they were already rare. And some of that market held up, a lot of it collapsed. I don't see the photo book market collapsing. As a matter of fact, it's still quite vibrant, and partially because a lot of the books are produced by small publishers using, really paying attention to this. If all the books are produced by the big mainstream publishing houses, there's just too many of them, and it's not going to maintain that interest, which photography has maintained. So anyway, I think this is kind of like the paramount example of a book that helped to make a field explode. And then there were these ripples, both good and bad, that this bookseller catalog and exhibition catalog had on the things to follow.
Yeah, I would add Ken Lopez's Vietnam and Indigenous.
Absolutely. And have you talked to Ken about those catalogs?
I haven't in as great a depth as I wish, but I have. Yeah, I have talked to him.
He tells a story, and I'm paraphrasing here, but it's a good illustration of a different impact a catalog can have. When he put out I don't know whether it was the Native American one or the Vietnam catalog, but when he put them out, he would get huge orders from institutions. And there were mostly books that were not ridiculously rare books, but nobody had ever bothered to bring them together into a single collection of things and make people think, oh, this is a thing, this is a field, we should be thinking about this. So he'd put the catalog out, and it would, he'd sell a fair percentage of what was in the list. It would do very well. And then he put out the second one, and it did pretty well, but not quite as well. And he put out the third one, and it was like, maybe not crickets, but like close to crickets. And he talked to one of his librarian friends about this, and they said, well, you know, you showed us the way, and now, you know, we all
went out and found it ourselves.
If it wasn't available from you, we just sat there and looked it up on eBay or ABE. So they basically used his catalogs as shopping lists to shop at the cheaper store. It's like going, it's like, what do they call it? Showrooming, when people would walk in, take pictures of my books and leave before I broke their phone, and then go home and buy the book on Amazon.
I found a copy of his Vietnam catalog for like $10.
Yeah. A really, you know, those are important reference books. I mean,
yes, that brings us into the whole collecting area of bookseller catalogs. But, there's a couple of things here I want to put on the record. The different types of bookseller catalogs. There's the focus theme. There's a period that's emphasized. There can be a focus on an author or a publisher. And there can be a focus on a specific person's collection or personal archive or personal library. Any other areas? I mean, there's all sorts of ways that a bookseller catalog can group together books, but those are just some of the more obvious ones.
Well, yeah, in terms of talking about the way material is organized within them, that's right. You know, what you do see shift over time is what are the subject areas that people are looking at? How does that change? And sometimes it's because, you know, booksellers are now putting out catalogs on fields that may have been around, but now the field is sort of big enough that somebody can do something like Lauren Baer, who's a good buddy of mine. He's not the first bookseller to deal in radical political material, but I believe he's really the first person to give it sort of full bookseller catalog treatment, with catalogs that are, you know, sort of thematically arranged and color illustrated. And his catalog 30, Three Centuries of American Radicalism is really an amazing book, and I say book in the broader sense, beyond bookseller catalog, because you can sit and read this, and not only do you learn a good deal about three centuries of American radicalism, but you go away from it understanding what the material culture that informs history may be for this field. And I think that's one of the great things about bookseller catalogs. Like, you know, you and I may not be able to afford to buy whole categories of books in the world of rare books. We just can't do it. It's just, it'd never be possible. But I can have a half a dozen books, bookseller catalogs on my shelf by some of the greatest antiquarian booksellers and scholars on a certain field, whether it's American radicalism with Lauren Baer, or it's Renaissance typography with E.P. Goldschmidt, or one of the classics from the mid 20th century. I can have that. And I can look through those catalogs, and the books I could never afford, especially those Renaissance books, I can still sort of commune with what they are and come away with an understanding, not just of what the history is, but also of the fact that the history is drawn from physical objects living somewhere in the world. Most of those books now in big institutions, but that's where the history comes from. It comes from the material that is collected, ends up in institutions, people write about it. Obviously, there are other sources of history too, whether it's archaeology or oral recordings of people. But the vast amount of history comes from written and printed documents. And so to see all the documents in a field, or many of the documents in a field, in one place, and to read about them and to see, you know, what they physically look like, that to me is, it's not as good as owning those books or handling them myself, but it's the next best thing. I can't think of anywhere else I can have that experience, except, you know, you go to an exhibition and you look at stuff, or you can read about it, to see the connection between the field and the material that supports the field or informs the field. That's the magic that happens in a good bookseller catalog.
Well, the material too, it's like the proof, isn't it? Which is so exciting. This is what people wrote and read at that point.
Yes. And also, you know, we think about the history of the press. And by that, I mean like the printing press, and whether the printing press leads to newspapers or political broadsides or grocery circulars or Darwin's Origin of the Species, it all comes from the printing press. And so whether it's a printed book by, you know, one of the great printer designers in history, or a printed book by a group of community of church ladies producing a community cookbook, or it is a, you know, a political tract or a handbill or a piece of currency. It's all produced by this printing press, and it all informs our sense of history. And the bookseller catalog is just one of those places where someone can go and at a relatively, in most cases, reasonable entry price and often free, can actually live that little bit of that experience.
That's a pretty compelling reason to collect them. Do you have any others?
Well, I don't know if it's that as compelling as that, but you know, you can see changes in the history of the approaches of booksellers to books. There's a catalog I just received.
Yeah, why do you collect them? I mean, it informs your business. But why, other than that?
It's amazing how much basic information is still not out there in other forms besides within bookseller catalogs. If I want detailed information about a book I'm cataloging, you know, I can find out certain things using OCLC and other digital library records, and I can go into the individual libraries and look at their records. But, you know, the standards of cataloging are different at different times and different places, you know, so it's very hard to tell whether the first edition of a certain book was published by this publisher or by a different, especially 19th century American stuff. It's kind of a mess. Mm-hmm. So there's the practical level of helping me to determine what something is. Then I like thinking about the way people think about books. And I know that that's pretty meta, but that's something that I'm really fascinated by. When, you know, in the 19th and early 20th century, people wrote hundreds of books about owning books, about reading books, about collecting books, about putting books on a shelf, about taking books off a shelf, you know, about putting books in a box. I mean, there are just so many things to read. And some of them are quite laughable, and others are really marvelous. And, you know, the greatest for me still being Walter Benjamin's on Unpacking My Library, which I think is one of the great statements about book ownership ever written. But the bookseller catalog shows me a great deal about the posture of a bookseller towards the material that they're selling. And, you know, there's a debate that goes on frequently amongst antiquarian booksellers about what antiquarian bookseller really means. A lot of people say, oh, that means the seller of antiquarian books. And I don't agree with that at all. I think it's a bookseller who has an antiquarian posture towards his material. And an antiquarian is a very specific thing. You know, they mostly were sort of existing in England and Northern Europe in the late 18th century and early 19th century. And they started to look at ruins, and they looked at Stonehenge, and they looked at old manuscripts, and they tried to figure out what this stuff was, and, you know, frequently republished old things. But they were just interested in old stuff because they knew it told them something. Because they knew that if put in the right context, it could illuminate something. That's what an antiquarian bookseller is. It's about the posture towards the material and the context into which they offer their material. And the catalog is the most permanent example of that we have.
I like the way that it displays how someone is trying to convince you that this is an important book.
Yes.
You know, it's like, okay, so what's your argument? And the persuasion of it, the salesmanship, that's also, I think, for me, quite interesting.
I think that that's absolutely right. And I think some people may hear that and think of it as being purely mercantile. And I don't think it is.
It's, as you said, it's sort of this antiquarian worldview. It's like, these are important because they tell us about ourselves. They tell us about the past and the future.
It's related to this idea I've had that if antiquarian bookselling were a religion, then pricing a book, a bookseller pricing a book, would be its holiest sacrament. And by that I mean that it is, when a bookseller prices a book, it could simply be writing a price on the page, $10, informed by whatever they know. And that's one version of it. And that is just as valid as the other version, which is the other extreme, which is that somebody spends days, weeks, months researching something in order to truly know what it is, in order to truly find out what it is at the most minute level, so that when they put it out there into the world can understand what it is. And then they put the price on it. It's not so much that the writing of the price, it, but the idea that the pricing is basically that whole idea of describing. That you're looking at it and you're saying, this is what it is. This is, and it's, as you said, this is why it's important.
Yeah, it's persuading you of the value of something.
Yeah, it is. And I hope when people hear that again, that they think of value as being well beyond the mercantile, well beyond just the financial. I've often thought that, you know, perhaps one of the places of friction between booksellers and librarians, and there often has been, not always. I have lots of really good people that are friends of mine in the library world, but that one of the areas of friction is that in a way it's the librarian's job to put value on nothing. In other words, that all of it is potentially important. Of course, there are all sorts of divisions about how those decisions are made. But in the sort of biggest version of the library world, that's what it is. It's like that all of this information would be available to everyone. And that's what we hope it is. But for the bookseller, it's like we have to put the value on things. And that idea that for all the other things we share, all the other activities we do that are similar, which is many things, that's where we're kind of in, we're not at loggerheads, but that's where we're different.
But you have to, as a librarian, you have to select and prioritize, right?
Sure. And so I want to give you one more example of something that arrived in my mail today. And it was just so cool that this arrived, because it was partially, there's somebody involved in this I was thinking about, because he just had an anniversary working with the company. It's a catalog that came from Bromer Booksellers in Boston. And if you know Bromer, they're primarily dealers, very, very long-term, fine, respected dealers in artist books and in fine printing and calligraphy and things like that. And it's not a world I overlap with all that often, but I've known Ann Bromer for a long time, and Phil Salmon, who works for her, and he's just experiencing his 20th anniversary with the company, which is great. So I get this catalog in the mail today, and it is, again, artist books, fine press, things like that. And the catalog is called Pressing Issues. And it's got what is clearly a sort of protest image on the front cover. And on the back, it's got this text, and the image and the text is drawn from one of the books within, but it's freedom, equality, righteousness, tranquility. This is a very large, thick catalog of material on basically contemporary issues. Gender issues, sexuality issues, issues of diversity and color, issues of violence, issues, all sorts of issues as they're reflected in the materials in the artist books that Bromer Booksellers is selling. And what's so interesting to me, and I'm an outsider, I don't know what decisions led to making this catalog, but I can tell you that we're living in a different time. The news is reflecting issues differently. We're learning, I'm personally learning more about myself and my place in the world and what's been going on than I thought I was aware of. But it's there's a lot going on. Institutions are asking for materials that reflect these new concerns, that reflect the desire to have unrepresented communities more represented in institutions, that desire for material that talks about different issues than the ones that they've been collecting for 200 years. I think it's great. It creates some difficulties for booksellers. Like in my field, I can look all I want. It's hard to find really good material that addresses those types of issues. Every once in a while, I find something. The things I find are usually not the kinds of things that I could use to support my business with. I need to continue doing all of what I do. But this catalog, I think, is just a great example of, you know, I've known the Bromer catalogs for ages now, and I've seen them, and I still have the ones that I care about that address specific topics I really am interested in. I thought I knew what those catalogs were about. And then in the mail today, this catalog shows up that, like, is still artist books, fine press material, fine printing. It's still what they do. It's still what they're, but it's now organized in a different way. It's now presenting these ideas that, and, you know, maybe, and again, this is, I don't want to project too much onto them, but you know, this living in today's world has forced them, as it does most people, to reevaluate our own world we're in. And they look on their shelves and say, oh my gosh, there are through paths that are different from the ones we saw before.
Okay, and so why did, what does that have to do with collecting bookseller catalogs?
It has a lot of things to do with books. So it
collecting them.
There's always a way in collecting anything to start looking at material freshly, to look at material that, you know, a category of material you've never thought of. And today our category is bookseller catalogs. And to start to look for those things, you know, that illustrate an idea that's in your head. And you have to see enough stuff before you know whether those ideas actually apply. But, you know, you could say, I want to think about the bookselling and the African-American experience. Like, where is there overlap? Has there been overlap? Who put out catalogs that dealt with this material? If not single issue catalogs, who put out material catalogs that had a good number of books in them because that was an interest of theirs? And then you can think about whether or not that's a good, you know, once you start to see enough of it, you can start to say, is this a good thing, a bad thing? Is this, what does this tell me about the institution of book collecting and the institution of book selling? And that's just like one quick example. But the institution changes and you can see the changes through the catalogs. Society changes, which influences the booksellers and influences their catalogs. And you could, depending on what your interests are, you could collect that. It's hard for me to, off the top of my head, come up with, you know, the 14 ideas, because what, to me, the collector has to only do two things. I've spoken with you about this before. The collector has to decide what it is they want to collect and have some sort of parameters that make sense for them. Like, can I afford collecting Renaissance medical texts? No. So that doesn't make sense. I got to pick something that I can actually collect. And they make parameters, and those parameters can change as they learn and as they see things. They can expand or contract. The second part of it is that you have to go and just do the work of collecting. And the work of collecting could be sitting at a computer and combing through, you know, auctions and eBay and online selling sites. It could be building relationships with dealers to make sure that you see certain types of materials first. It could be going to flea markets, or it could be going to international book fairs. You just have to do the work. Okay. And if you've chosen your scope carefully, you can build a collection that's actually important, not expensive, not take up a lot of room, but still important because nobody had that little idea. And I think within bookselling catalogs, there's a lot of possibility, a lot of opportunities to see things related to the history of books, the history of ideas, the history of society and culture. But there's a challenge too. And the challenge is that because these things were produced outside of normal publishing, because most people, including libraries, don't really think of them as anything but ephemeral.
Yeah, thrown away.
It's not easy to find where they live. You know, there are some booksellers that you can find them more often than others. And there are, you know, there's a lot of browsing at ephemera shows, and there's a lot of online browsing. But every last book of tiny poetry has been cataloged, and it's probably available online with some super rare exceptions. But booksellers' catalogs, by and large, no. So that's the challenge, is to actually doing the work of finding them. You have to build relationships. And
okay, well, you know, for me anyway, These things, many of them are just stunningly beautiful. They're not that expensive, and they also represent a ton of work. So these are all pretty, for me anyway, persuasive reasons to pay attention to them.
Absolutely. And I'm just going to sort of bookend your comments and everything we spoke about by saying that people have recognized that these things are important besides you and me and people looking to buy books through them. But there have been books like Archer Taylor's book catalogs, Their Varieties and Uses, which is the sort of classic text on it.
I didn't find too much in there, I must say. I've read through it. I didn't find a whole hell of a lot in there.
I think for looking at the early material, I mean, you know, 18th century bookseller catalogs and like, there's stuff, but not so much about the sort of environment of the modern catalog. But for that, there are a couple of things. The most recent thing is this Monster by John Payne. It's 14 inches tall and 3 inches thick, and It's called Great Catalogs by Master Booksellers.
You're lucky to have that, though, because it's damn hard to find and it's expensive.
It's very, very expensive. It's limited, 500 copies. It's very interesting because it, like any one of these things, it immediately makes you debate. Like, why is this in there and not that? Like, this should definitely be in there, and that's not really that interesting. But that's what these books are great for, is to make you think, like, what, you know?
Yeah.
The 100 best bookseller catalogs by many of the people we've discussed today are in here.
You can get that list online, yes, which is good.
I've actually been very lucky to be out about in the world. You know, I found, I had some, but then there were like at least six or seven I've found since I got this. It's nice. They reproduce like prefaces and introductions. I wish there was just a couple of sentences about why they think these are the most important.
Yes.
They often leave that out. And I kind of know what they're talking about, but they don't say it. so that's one. The others, two, and I think there's a third book, all done by Jürgen Holstein in Germany, who is also the author of a lot of these sort of monster books on the historical avant-garde material and history of design stuff. So he's really interested in printed material. And this one is called Booker Kunst und Katalog. And it's really, it's just all bookseller catalogs. There are also some German auction catalogs. The sort of, the line between auction house and dealer in Germany is much fuzzier than it is here. Okay. But this has books by some of the people we've spoken about today. Lame Duck is in here. There's a lot of European material, as you can imagine. And this has a lot more sort of bigger essays on the concept of the bookseller catalog, although it is all in German.
Yeah.
This one, which is Goldrausch and Werther, is also antiquarian booksellers catalogs, but it is all about the cover design.
Oh, nice.
And there's some really crazy stuff in here, including folks like Goodspeeds, next to these sort of avant-garde catalogs. So these are just examples of how people have spent a lot of time and expense and effort to put together books that celebrate the bookseller catalog and try to make the argument, as I think the two of us are doing today, that these things are deserving of our attention and also deserving of our collecting. There's one other, since these books are obviously flattery about bookseller catalogs, there's one that I'll leave us with. This is a literary interpretation of a bookseller's catalog. And there are actually a couple of these, but this is a book by Rick Moody, the contemporary novelist, Rick Moody, and it's called Surplus Value Books, Catalog Number 13. The catalog itself and all of the books described within are fake. So it is flattering the genre of the bookseller catalog with its sort of mockery of the whole thing. Okay. Everything from the way the condition is described to the descriptions of the object, of the items themselves. And so it's a marvelous thing. And you know, bookselling catalogs have made it big when people are mocking them. Right? I think that's a sign that you've made it when people start mocking you.
Well, Don, I think when this goes to air, I figured there's going to be a stampede. So we need to gather these. Well, you've got a ton of them already. I need to gather a bunch of them up before the stampede happens.
That's right. Well, we're creating a new market in bookseller catalogs right
here.
Yes,
we are. Yes,
not
we are.
Through a bookseller catalog, but through a podcast. There's your modern form.
Well, it's been a real pleasure. It's, you know, it doesn't seem like we've talked for however many hours. It's been a delight to talk to you, Don, as it always is.
It's terrific. And you know, we've talked about this subject for a little while now, and of course, things being as they have been for the last while, it was tough to fit stuff in, but I'm glad we did this. And I look forward to seeing how it comes out. And I appreciate your wanting to talk about this with me. Thanks so much, Nigel.
Don Lindgren is the founder and proprietor of Rabelais Books, specializing in all things cookery.
Yes.
Based in Biddeford, Maine. Thanks again, Don.
Thank you, Nigel. You have a good day.